So we've been looking at the life of Elisha. We're coming towards the end now. Just a few more incidents to look at. And the one I want us to look at today is in the passage we read earlier, second book of Kings, chapter 8, and the first six verses. And not for the first time, Elisha's not really in this story. He's very much in the background, and yet he's quite central to the whole thing. And what's different about this section, I suppose, is that most of the stories about Elisha feature miracles, amazing things that he did. And in this story, he doesn't actually do a miracle, although his great acts are there in the background and they're referred to throughout. What it is quite a short, but it's an interesting story about Elisha and about some of the lives that he touched. And I suppose it's really about the providence and the power of God. So I think when you come to a passage like this, you've got to say, now why has the writer included this? Why when he's telling us? Because obviously there are lots of things. We just read about Manasseh and how there were other books in those days. We could read lots more about Manasseh. We don't have those books anymore. But we do have what the chronicler thought we needed to know under God. I think you have to ask that sort of question. Say, well, why? Why did the writer of the second book of Kings want us to know about these particular things? I think part of the answer is that he knows that miracles are not an everyday feature in most periods of history. Even in the Bible, miracles are fairly unusual. There's lots of them, of course, altogether. But if you take all the years that are covered by the Bible, there are not a great number of miracles. And so he talks about four very different people and about some of the providences that affected their lives. And he talks about the power of God. And I think if for a moment then we're tempted to think of the stories of Elisha that we have as sort of legends, things that happened in some sort of, not sort of real history, but some sort of fairy tale history, I think a passage like this brings it home to us that these people, they're real flesh and blood individuals. And it reminds us of the way that God worked in different ways in their lives. So I think there are really three subjects here for us then, all beginning with P. Providence, people, and power. And we'll spend most of the time on providence and people. And I want to say something at the end about power. So first of all, consider the providence of God and the way it unfolds. Now you may be saying, well, what does that word mean then? What does providence mean? You can probably see it comes from the word provide. So it's to do with the way God provides. So in the Baptist Catechism that we've been looking at, isn't it? You may remember a few weeks ago we came to question 15. What are God's works of providence? And the answer given is that God's works of providence are his most holy, wise, and powerful, preserving and governing all his creatures and all their actions. So what God does is holy, it's wise, it's for the best, it's obviously powerful because he's controlling so much, and it involves him preserving and governing not just Christians, but everybody. And not just human beings, but angels and animals and every single thing. Every single thing. God then, works out his purposes in each case. So God's providence is the way he provides for people then. He preserves, he governs all his creatures and all their actions. And then if we go on to think, well, how does that work out? I think that from this passage, we can think of at least eight sorts of providence. Now, I've never seen these listed anywhere else. This is just something that occurred to me as I was looking at this passage. But I think, you know, it's one thing, isn't it, to say the providence of God. Everything that happens, happens because it's God's will. But what does that mean in practice? And I think this passage helps us to think about it. So first of all, let's think about extraordinary providences. Extraordinary providences or extraordinary provinces, if you want to say the word like that. That's what the word extraordinary is, isn't it? Extraordinary. Now, the sort of providence that is most common in the stories we have of Elisha is the sort of providence, I suppose, that we know least about, extraordinary providence. And such providences are very special indeed, then, because they contradict the normal patterns of life. You know, normally, rivers don't part to let you walk through. That doesn't normally happen. But it happened to Elisha. Dead people. Once they're dead, they're dead. I mean, you do come across cases of poor Christians praying earnestly that somebody will be raised from the dead. And it's very sad to see that. But it doesn't happen. People don't get... I know you hear stories of people being raised from the dead, but I assure you that doesn't happen. That's not the norm, is it? And yet, here is Elisha, and he's able to raise this boy from the dead. Iron floating. That doesn't normally happen. You throw an axe head into the water, it goes to the bottom, and you won't see that axe head again. And all these other things, then, that are connected with the story of Elisha. Lepers being healed, and unseen things being seen, and unknown things being known, and loaves multiplying, lepers being healed, armies retreating for no apparent reason. There are people, of course, who don't believe in miracles. And they don't believe in miracles because they say, well, they're extraordinary. They can't happen. Well, there doesn't seem to be much logic to that. I think there's plenty of evidence that miracles do happen. Certainly in the scriptures, we see that happening. And I think what happens, if you reject extraordinary providence, you say a miracle can't happen. It isn't very long before you reject ordinary providence. Most people who say that God can't do miracles, they usually go on to say God can't do anything. He doesn't do anything at all. And so it's important that we accept that there are extraordinary providences. Even today, there are things that happen that we can't explain. There's no reason, there's no obvious logic to them. People have cancer, and then suddenly they don't have cancer. And no doctor can explain it, no individual can explain it. It happens, it does happen. And whether we want to call that a miracle or whether we want to just say it's extraordinary, it's certainly extraordinary, isn't it? So extraordinary providences. As I say, that's the thing we'll be dealing with least. Most of your life, it won't be extraordinary providences. But there is such a thing as extraordinary providence. And then there's coincidence. Again, coincidence. Things happen at the same time. And coincidences are fascinating, I think, aren't they? And what we mean by coincidence, different people obviously mean different things. We mean where two or more events occur at the same time, apparently by chance. It's not like you can say, oh, well, it's no surprise that happened. You look at it and you say, well, how did that happen? It's like when lightning strikes in the same place twice. You say, well, that's amazing. How did that happen? There's even a saying, isn't there? Lightning never strikes twice, but it does sometimes, rarely, but it does strike in exactly the same spot. I remember reading a story of a garden somewhere in Italy. The grandfather was struck, and then some years later, the grandson was struck. Same place, the lightning struck both of them. It happens. It happens. And we've got an example of it here in verse 7. Just as Gehazi was telling the king how Elisha had restored the dead to life, who should come into the room but the woman whose son Elisha had brought back to life? She came begging the king for her house and her land. And Gehazi was just amazed. This is the woman, he says, my lord the king. And this is her son. He's the son, of course, who's, well, certainly 7 years older than when they'd last met. And, a grown man. He says, this is the very boy, I'm telling you, was raised from the dead. And that wasn't a miracle, of course, as such. But it was a remarkable bit of timing, wasn't it, that he should be talking about that particular family when that particular family should come into the room. And... especially when you think she'd been away for 7 years. So I suppose she could have, in theory, come back at any point. And for it to be at this very moment that Gehazi is speaking to the king. I suppose I'm not a mathematician, as you know, but mathematically, the chances of that happening, I would think, must be pretty unlikely. Now, those who look at such things are quick to point out, for various reasons, that coincidences are common. I think we have to say that. Coincidences are common. Once you start talking about this, or you can read books just stuffed full with these stories. Now, it's always difficult to be sure whether they're true or not. It's very difficult to verify. But it seems to me, having looked at the subject a little bit, that they are common. And anyway, we've all got a story, haven't we? Let me give you mine. So I'm a young man. I went to India. We went to some pretty remote parts of India, and I remember one day myself and there was a fellow from Cardiff University, Emer, and Emer and I were walking through this Indian village, and Emer bumps into somebody he knows. "Oh," he said, "didn't know you were coming to India." I didn't know you were coming to India either. So they knew each other back in Cardiff University. They didn't know that they were both going to be going to India. They certainly didn't know they were going to be in the same village at the same time. And yet, they were not only in the same small town, say, village, you know, but they actually bumped into each other at that time. Now, that's just as fluky, isn't it? That's just weird. And I'm sure you've all got a story that you could tell me. Maybe you'll do that afterwards. And people are fascinated with it, isn't it? We know a fellow, he's a plumber from Glasgow, Don. And I remember Don telling me this story. He had a plumbing job in Hemel Hempstead. So he went to the place where he was supposed to do the work. And when he got to the house, the front door was ajar. And there was the car was in the drive. And, you know, there was plenty of life going on. But there was nobody there. So he didn't want to go in. Until there was somebody there to invite him in. Now, it was a sort of cul-de-sac, and so he looked around, I don't know, five, six houses, whatever they were, and he thought he'd knock on one of the doors and see if somebody else knew where this mysterious person had disappeared to. And what he was struck about was that the door he knocked was the door of a man who, whatever it was, 20 years before, he'd sat next to in school in Glasgow. Now, it doesn't, you know, the striking thing is that these two boys from Glasgow should meet with each other in Hemel Hempstead all those years later. That's the thing, isn't it? That's the thing. I don't think it proves anything, but it does strike you, doesn't it? And you know, he was very eager to tell me that story when he told it to me. I think particularly because I'm a minister, and it doesn't prove the existence of God. Is it? You can't say, look, there are coincidences that proves the existence of God, but there are coincidences, and that makes you think about the providence of God. And it makes you think, well, are we really going to say then that's just pure fluke? There's no sense to it. My favorite one more, I have to rash myself. This one happened in Detroit in the 1930s. And there's a young mother, obviously not a particularly careful mother, because what happens is that a man called Joseph Figlock, there's a real name here, isn't it? You can't make up a name like Joseph Figlock. He's walking down the street, and as he's walking down the street, her baby falls out of the window, there, sort of further up. The baby falls, and it's the timing is the thing, so that just as Joseph Figlock comes underneath, the baby lands on him. He's not hurt, the baby's not hurt, but the baby, you know, it might well have died otherwise. Now, that's an amazing thing, isn't it, to think that he could be walking at that. But then, this is where it gets ridiculous. A year later, the same thing happened. Oh, how could that possibly? But apparently, that's what happened. He comes, and this woman is obviously rather careless with her baby, I think, isn't she? And again it happens. They both survive the event. So as I say, I don't think coincidences prove that God exists, but they do make you think, don't they? They do make you think. And I would guess that one of the things that God does is now and again just to show us. You know, you meet somebody. I've met people in central London, isn't it? You know, it's a big place, isn't it, central London? But you bump into people and say, oh, hello, what are you doing in London? It does happen. And obviously you can show how it happens, isn't it? It's like that story of the two sisters who crash into each other and kill each other. They say, well, they were obviously both bad drivers and so on. You explain it that way. But it's still a weird thing when coincidences like that happen. And I think that they're there to make us sit up and to think, because not only coincidences, but everything else as well. It's all part of God's problems. Okay, we spent a bit long on that. So, coincidences, that's the second. And thirdly, dark providences. Now, some providences are delightful, and they're an obvious blessing, but others are dark, and sometimes they're mysterious. In this passage, Elisha tells this woman to go away with her family and to stay for a while wherever she could, because the Lord has decreed a famine that's going to last for 7 years. Now, there'd been a 3.5-year drought in Elijah's time, but now it was going to be double that time, and there was going to be this great famine. And this famine, I'm sure, was due to the unfaithfulness of Israel. There was a reason for it. Sometimes we do know the reason why a trouble has come. Sometimes we don't know. We don't know why a particular thing has happened. And we rarely know how long it's going to last, is it? You don't know how long a thing is going to last. And there are dark providences then. Famine and war and earthquake and plague. And we can think of lots of situations where people are really going through it. And maybe as individuals this morning, we're really up against it. And that's part of God's providence, dark providences. And then there are, to make a slightly different case, strange providences. And that could cover many things, but I'm thinking here of how this godly woman then, she found herself living amongst the godless Philistines. She was a godly woman. She kept the festivals, the new moon festivals and so on. But she couldn't do that when she lived amongst the Philistines. And of course it had happened to David many years before as well. And there are situations where we wouldn't choose those situations. But we have to face them. You know, living in the United Kingdom, some of you wouldn't choose to live in the United Kingdom, nothing against us, but you did this, you know, some of us were brought up here, some of us weren't. You said, well, no, it's not that my life's ambition was to live in England. No, it's all right. I'd rather be living at home, but I'm living at home. Or living in London, for that matter. Some of you, I don't know what your feeling is about living in London. Certainly when I first came here, the last place I really wanted to live, I must be honest. But anyway, you see, and you say, well, this is part of God's plan. This is part of God's purpose then for me. And so we find ourselves in sometimes strange circumstances. There are strange providences. And then fifthly, we can talk about judicial providence. And I think judicial providence has got a meaning of its own, which I'm not sure what it does mean. But I'm using it here to remind us that one of the ways in which God exercises his providence in this world then is through human justice. And God brings that about through kings and through lesser officials as well. Paul reminds us, doesn't he, in Romans chapter 13, that there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. That's why it's very difficult in a situation like we have in Libya, where you've got a man in power, Gaddafi. Clearly God has put him in power. And yet there are other powers, aren't there? There's the United Nations. There's this rebel government that's been set up. And so it's very difficult, isn't it, to sort all that out. And to know exactly how justice should be done. But we must pray that justice will be done there as well as elsewhere. And certainly, if we're treated unjustly, then we should normally have no hesitation in seeking legal redress, just as this woman does in the story. That's not a failure to trust God. That's rather a recognition of the providence of God and making use of what he has provided. And that's why, you know, the Christian Institute are particularly concerned for, you know, Christians are being treated unjustly at the moment. You know, a man preaches in a shopping centre, he's perfectly allowed to preach in a shopping centre, and then somebody comes up and tries to trick him into saying something that he shouldn't say, apparently, and he says that, they arrest him, take him away. But then he is perfectly allowed to say what he said, despite what the police said. And thanks to the Christian Institute and other people who've helped that man, and there are other situations like this, then justice has been done. So that's an important part of God's providence as well. And then six, providential advice. Providential advice. One aspect of providence, I don't think we think much about this, but providential advice. If Elisha hadn't told this woman that there was going to be a famine, and that she ought to get away, well, we don't know what might have happened. And there are proverbs. I began with some proverbs this morning, but there are proverbs that talk about the importance of taking good advice. Proverbs 12:15, the way of a fool seems right to him, but a wise man listens to advice. If you're wise, especially if you're making a big decision, but in the decisions you make, you will be willing to consult other people. Pride, this is 13:10, pride only breeds quarrels, but wisdom is found in those who take advice. Take advice. And there are lots of other proverbs like that. And that applies especially to preaching, is it? Now, preaching is a bit more than advice, but the things I'm saying to you now from the Word of God, isn't it? You'd be a very foolish person just to say, oh, I'm not going to listen to that. A wise person will listen and take advice. And two more things then, historical providence. Again, another aspect of providence that we don't think about very often is the way we are affected by what has happened in the past. Now, it was this woman's kindness in the past that prompted Elisha to be concerned for her at this particular time. And it was the king hearing about what Elisha had done in the past that prompted him to make sure that she got justice. And this is going on all the time. When they were talking about this no-fly zone over Libya, one of the obvious things that the news media did was to talk about no-fly zones that have been brought in the past. Some of them have been successful, some of them have been unsuccessful. And you try to learn, don't you, from the past. You try to learn from what's gone on. So I think both of those things, learning from the past, and we should try and do that as far as we can, recognizing how the past affects the present. I think those are lessons for us when it comes to looking at providence. And then the last one here is providential favors. The king helped the woman not simply because she had a good case, but because she was the woman whose son Elisha had raised, and that had impressed itself then on the king so that he made sure that she got justice. Now, of course, favoritism is often an evil thing. You've got to be very careful. The Bible speaks against favoritism. There is a wrong sort of favoritism, and we need to be aware of that. But I think we also need to be aware of how favor does. It makes such a difference in this world. You know, teachers have a class of children. They like some. They don't particularly like others. It makes a difference what happens. They try, I'm sure, to be fair. But it makes a difference. You know, you meet people. Some people you're instantly drawn to. You like them. Some people think, that's not such, it's not such an easy person to get on with. That's happening all the time. And the very fact then that God chose Jacob over Esau, and Rachel over Leah, and Ephraim over Manasseh, and so on. That made a tremendous difference in Israel's history. Now, I'm not saying that's a wrong sort of favoritism, but it is a favoring of one over another. It's part of the story of Esther as well, isn't it? If Esther had not become the queen, then the whole book of Esther, the whole story would have been quite different. And yet the king was drawn to this particular woman because she was lovely to look at. And inform. And we must recognize the part that plays. Even in international trading, you've got favored nation status, isn't it? Most favored nation. Some of our business people here will tell you all about that. But even at that level, once you say favoritism, it's a bad thing, isn't it? But favoring, that goes on. And we must recognize that that's the case. So we could say a lot more about providence, but let me just draw some final lessons before we move on to our second point. In 1658, the Puritan Obadiah Sedgwick published a book on the subject of providence. It's only a little book. You can get it in paperback form. And he says some very practical things about providence there. In fact, it's called A Practical View of Providence. And he says we need to depend on God's providence. We must recognize it, depend upon it. We mustn't worry. This is one of the reasons why we must never, vex our minds, as he puts it. We must never be worried, because we know that God is working out his purposes. And so he urges us to be patient. Patience is important, isn't it? To be contented in general. When dark providences come, we have to learn to accept our situation. That's the way it is. It's not what you wanted. It's not what you prayed for, but it is God's providence. On the other hand, we mustn't be complacent and say, oh, well, that's just the way it is. You know, the thing I can do. There are things to do. We must pray. That makes a difference, doesn't it? And we must do all that we can in the right direction. We must stir ourselves up to doing good. And we must always find a great comfort in remembering that God is in control. It isn't just happening by chance. It's not a fluke. The fact you're here this morning isn't you just happen to be here. No, it's God has brought you to hear this particular message at this particular time. Well, there's lots more we could say, but that's the matter of providence then. Now, what I want us to do secondly, and a little bit more briefly, is to consider the people that we read about in this story and the way their lives unfolded. So there are four characters altogether, aren't there? So first of all, there's Elisha. Elisha, the man of God. Elisha doesn't exactly appear here, but he's mentioned, isn't he? And I think there are two things here to note about him. First of all, he was greatly used by God. God used him. He lived in dark days, wicked days, tough days for God's people, when few in Israel faithfully worshipped the Lord as they should. Nevertheless, God took hold of him, and he did great things through Elisha. And that reminder of the impact that this godly man had should stir us up to pray. Pray for people like Elisha today, for godly people in our day, for people who will lead the people of God and bring glory to his name. We were praying earlier for the LTS. Pray that God will raise up men for the ministry, and that he will use LTS and institutions like it to train men for that ministry. And then secondly, this man, Elisha, was grateful to this woman, and he was kind to her. Elisha didn't sort of think of himself as so exalted, he really couldn't get involved with the lives of others. He wasn't a sort of man who was out of touch with people. When he realized that there was going to be a famine, he immediately told this woman. This woman had been such a help to him. He told her to go with her family, to stay where she could for a while. And I'm sure he warned others as well. It wasn't just her. He urged them then to do something about this. Back in 1624, John Donne published those famous words. You'll know some of these words, I'm sure. All mankind is of one author and is one volume. And then he goes on to talk about the bell that rings to a sermon. They would ring the bell to tell people to come and hear the preaching of the word of God. As therefore the bell that rings to a sermon calls not upon the preacher only, but upon the congregation to come. So this bell, I think he's talking there about the death knell, that bell. It calls us all. No man is an island, entire of itself. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. So when you hear a bell marking the death of somebody, you know, we're all affected by that. And it's that line, isn't it, that's often quoted, no man is an island. We can't hermetically seal ourselves off from other people, much as we may on occasions want to do that. We all depend on each other. And we must remember that interconnectedness. And particularly those that, who have positions of leadership must remember that there's that connection. And they must show the kindness of God to all who they interact with. So that's the first thing then. Elisha, this man of God. And then there's the woman, who I would describe as one of the godly remnant. She's very special in some ways, but she is one of those 7,000 who refused to bow the knee to Baal. And, three things about her. First of all, she was kind to the prophet, you may remember, and that led to her blessing. She is the one who saw that there was a need And so she provided, with her husband's consent, she provided this small room on the roof of her house for Elisha. There was a bed there and a table, a chair and a lamp. And that had led then to the unsought blessing of this son who died, first of all, but then who'd been raised again from the dead. And she's an example then of those who, they may not be preachers or leaders of the people of God. You may not read their biographies in years to come. But they are people who willingly make sacrifices so that the work of God should go on. And this woman is an example to us of that sort of thing. So she was kind to the prophet and she was blessed by him. But she did no troubles. You know, you sometimes think, now if I could sort of devote myself to God and I did, then my life would be smoother and easier. But it doesn't necessarily follow. As we are often saying then, even though you may be a Christian, even though you may be a very devoted Christian, even though you might be full of faith, you still may hit trouble. I know there are Christians today who deny that. They say, oh no, if you have trouble, it's because you lack faith. It's not always because you lack faith. That's not the case. And that wasn't the problem with this woman. It wasn't that she lacked faith. It was that this trouble had come upon the land because of the sins of others. And so she's a woman then who had troubles, but she took advice when she was warned. We've made this point already, haven't we? We need to be willing to listen to advice. We need to be willing to listen to the preaching of the Word of God. She had to live in an alien land for a while then. There are strange providences. Living amongst Philistines. It was the strangest part of her life, I'm sure. And yet, there wasn't much alternative, was there? And sometimes we do go through strange times. And then she nearly lost her worldly possessions. When she came back home, for some reason or another, she couldn't reclaim her property, the things that belonged to her. And troubles like that do come. We must recognize that that's the case. But part of the story here is that, as with Job then, in the end, she got back everything that belonged to her, including all the income from her land from the day she left until left the country until that present point. And so 7 years that she might have missed out on otherwise, it was all restored to her. And she was blessed in the end. Now, the lesson there is not that everything will, you know, for every Christian then, although you may go through a bit of trouble, it'll all turn all right in the end. Surely the lesson, rather, is that, yes, it will all turn out right in the end, but not necessarily in this life. It's the world to come that the Bible is always encouraging us to look to. And so we do go through many hardships to enter the kingdom of God, as Paul says. But in the end, let's never forget this, paradise will be ours. Every blessing. It is beyond our imagination to imagine what a delightful place heaven is. And we ought often to be thinking about that. And so then these light and momentary troubles that we go through here on this earth, they don't begin to compare, do they, with the glory that's going to come. So there's that woman then, one of the godly remnants. She's worth thinking about, I'm sure. And then there's Gehazi the backslider. I'm sure that this story is not given in strict chronological order. Otherwise, you have to have a leper talking to the king, which is possible, I suppose, but unlikely, isn't it? I think that the writer has deliberately put these stories in a different order, so that when you read about Gehazi, you know he's a backslider. You know then that he's turned from the truth and God has punished him. And so I think in the light of that, we can say two things. First of all, here's a man who was able to tell of good things to do with the man of God. Gehazi was an insider. He was Elisha's servant. He knew perhaps more than anyone what Elisha was like and the sort of man of God that he was. And that's why the king was so eager to talk to him. He wanted to know about Elisha. And some of you, you are in that privileged position. You're on the inside, aren't you? You know what goes on in Christian circles. I grew up myself on the outside. I didn't know any Christian ministers or hardly any Christians at first. So I've seen it from both sides. On the outside and then on the inside as well. And I think we can try and look at things from both sides. Try and see it from the outsider's point of view as well as from the insider's point of view. And being on the inside has its advantages. It is something to be thankful for if, as would be the case with many of you, you are on the inside, aren't you? You know about these things. But Gehazi, of course, he threw away all those advantages for the love of money, for the love of money. And it is important to remember that if you're on the inside, that doesn't guarantee anything. You don't say, well, I grew up in a Christian family, I come to church every week, I know people, I'm a deacon, I'm a minister, I'm on the inside. Well, you may be on the inside, but if you throw it all away, like Gehazi did, then it will be of no advantage to you. There is no automatic ticket to heaven. I heard this week of the death of a man. Strange, really. I don't think I ever met this man, but I know his father. I've met his mother. I've met his brother and sister. I've been in the home where he grew up. And this man, Matthew, his name is, had a fairly privileged upbringing, and he was brought up in a Christian home. They were quite well off. He became a policeman, and in his early 20s he got married, and in fact they were living in Finchley, so they're not that far away. I sort of heard about them. They were in the Kendrick Church, I believe. And you do shift work in the police. That was a difficulty. You can't get to church regularly. It's one of the dangers, I suppose, of shift work, if you can't get to church regularly. And as I understand it then, and as I say, I don't know that, didn't know this man, but he developed a problem with drink, with alcohol, and there were tensions in the marriage and so on. And just things went worse, and his health then began to suffer. So he died February the 22nd. He was 43. He was young. Now, I don't know, I'm only saying I understand that it's the drink that affected his health. It may have been something else, I don't know. But it's a very sad story. And we have heard that he did come back to the Lord and profess faith. And well, hopefully that's true, that he did repent and turn to the Lord. Like Manasseh, who we've just been reading about. But it's a tragic story, isn't it? To grow up right there on the inside. You know, his brother's a minister or a preacher. And grew up in a godly home, godly church, and yet it all lost like that. You know, now that could be any one of us, couldn't it? We could so easily drift, like Gehazi did. And it's a warning to us, I think. And then finally, there's this apostate king. King Jehoram, this is. And again, we can say three things. He was interested, wasn't he, in the miracles of Elisha, like Gehazi was then. Tell me about all the great things Elisha has done. That's the way he was at this particular point. We don't know, as I said, quite how the whole story fits together chronologically. But at this point, he was very interested. And you can be interested in the right things, and it can lead you nowhere. It can lead you nowhere. And then secondly, he was concerned for this woman, wasn't he? His interest in Elisha led to him assigning this official to make sure that this woman got justice. And people can do apparently very kind things to God's people, and yet they don't really belong to the people of God. They remain in their hearts on the outside. And that's the third thing, isn't it? He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Right back in chapter 3, we haven't looked at this because we're just concentrating on Elisha, but right, if you go back to chapter 3, the opening verses talk about Joram, or sometimes he's called Jehoram, sometimes he's called Joram. There's another Joram as well in Judah as well. But this Joram, we're told then, the son of Ahab, became king of Israel in Samaria. It was the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah. And he reigned for 12 years, and he did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Not as his father and mother had done. He wasn't like Ahab and Jezebel. He got rid of the sacred stone of Baal that his father had made. Nevertheless, he clung to the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, the first king of Israel, which he had caused Israel to commit. He did not turn away from them. He was a godless king. And this is probably the closest he ever got to being anything else. And again, it's a tragedy. And it's another reminder that not everyone is saved. And so there's no place for complacency or for assuming anything. You know, you'd like to assume that everybody who's a church member or everybody who comes on Sunday must be a Christian, but you can't assume that, can you? Because there are some people who get that close and yet they haven't got the root of the matter in them. They're not trusting in the Lord Jesus Christ. And so make no assumptions then. Recognize that you can be that close and yet you can end in hell. So the providence of God, these people who we've mentioned, and then finally, very briefly, the power of God and the way God can restore to life. Final point then is about the power of God. One writer points out that you've got a phrase repeated, or a word rather, repeated in this section. I don't know if you noticed it. Did you notice that there's one, it's a phrase actually in our Bibles. If you look at verse 1, you'll see it there. Chapter 8, verse 1. Now Elisha had said to the woman, and how is she described? Whose son he had restored to life. Okay, you say, well, she's got to be referred to somehow, hasn't she? So she's referred to as the woman who whose son he had restored to life. But if you go on to verse 5, then it gets a bit more deliberate, doesn't it? Just as Gehazi... just as Gehazi was telling the king how Elisha had, what had he done? Restored the dead to life. The woman whose son Elisha had brought back to life came to beg the king for her house and land. And Gehazi said, this is the woman, my lord the king. And this is the son whom Elisha restored to life. So you get three times there. And when you come to the final verse, verse 6, you also have, and it's a different word here, but it's still the same idea. Give back. Restore them. Give back everything that belonged to her, including all the income from her land, from the day she left. And there is an emphasis, I think it's fair to say then, on God's power to restore. You see, I think that the danger with a sermon like this is that you might just end up thinking about yourself at the end of the sermon. Whereas always we want to be thinking about God. All the glory must be his. He is the one with all power. And he's not only the God of providence then, but he's also the God of power. He's the God who can convert the ungodly. He can convert a Manasseh. He could, if he chose, convert a Joram. He could restore, maybe he did, a Gehazi. We don't know what happened to Gehazi. But he can convert the ungodly so that they're born again and raised to life, so that they might live a resurrection life. And if nothing else, we should learn from this passage to look to God now and always. May we do that. Amen.